figures, maybe more, closing in on them from several directions. Chapter 6. The figures approach from across the median, and from behind the flaming debris of the wreck, and from the adjacent woods, all shapes and sizes, faces the color of spackling compound, eyes gleaming like marbles in the firelight. Some are burned. Some are in tatters. Some are so well-dressed and groomed they look as though they just came from church. Most have that curled lip exposed incisor look of insatiable hunger. Shit! Brian looks at his brother. What are you gonna do? What are you thinking? Get your ass in the car, Brian. Shit! Shit! Brian hurries around to the side door, throws it open, and climbs in next to Penny, who is looking around with a bewildered expression. Brian slams the door and smashes down the lock. Lock the doors, Nick! I'm gonna help him! Nick goes for his goose gun and opens his door, but he stops abruptly when he hears the strange sound of Philip's flat, cold, metallic tone through the open rear hatch. I got this. Do what he says, Nick. Lock the doors and stay down. There's too many of them! Nick is thumbing the hammers on the Marlin, already with his right leg out the door, his work boot on the pavement. Stay in the car, Nick. Philip is digging out a pair of matched log splitters. A few days ago, we found the small axes in a garden shed of a mansion at Wiltshire Estates. Two matched, balanced implements of razor-sharp carbon steel. And at the time, he wondered what in the world some fat rich guy, who probably paid a yard service to split his firewood, would want a pair of small bad axes for. In the front seat, Nick pulls his leg back inside the SUV, slams his door, and bangs the lock down. He twists around with his eyes blazing and the gun cradled in his arms. What the hell? What are you doing, Philly? The rear hatch slams. The silence crashes down on the interior. Brian looks down at the child. I'm thinking maybe you ought to get down on the floor, kiddo. Penny says nothing as she slides down the front of the seat and then curls into a fetal position. Something in her expression, some glint of knowing in her big soft eyes, reaches out to Brian and puts the squeeze on his heart. He pats her shoulder. We'll get through this. Brian turns and peers over the back seat, over the cargo and out through the rear window. Philip has a bad axe in either hand and is calmly walking toward the converging crowd of zombies. Jesus, Brian utters under his breath. What's he doing, Brian? Nick's voice is high and taut, his hands fingering the Marlin's bolt. Brian can't muster a response, because he is now held wrapped by the terrible sight through the window. It's not pretty. It's not graceful, or cool, or heroic, or manly, or even well executed. But it feels good. I got this, Philip says to himself under his breath as he lashes out at the closest one, a heavy-set man in farmer's dungarees. The bad axe shears off a grapefruit-sized lobe of the fat one's skull, sending a geyser of pink matter into the night air. The zombie falls, but Philip doesn't stop. Before the next closest one can reach him, Philip goes to work on the big flaccid body on the ground, windmilling the cold steel in each hand down on the dead flesh. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. Blood and tissue fountain. Sparks kick off the pavement with each blow. I got this. I got this. I got this. Philip murmurs to no one in particular, letting all the pent-up rage and sorrow come out in a flurry of glancing blows. I got this. 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 By this point, others have closed in. A skinny young man with black fluid dripping off his lips. A fat woman with a bloated, dead face. A guy in a bloody suit. And Philip spins away from the mangled corpse on the ground to go to work on the others. He grunts with each blow. I got this! Cleaving skulls. I got this! Severing carotid arteries. I got this! Letting his anger drive the cold steel through cartilage and bone and nasal cavities. I got this! The blood and brain matter misting up across his face as he remembers the foaming mouth of rabid fangs coming for him when he was a kid, and God taking his wife Sarah, and the monsters taking his best friend Bobby Marsh. I got this. I got this. I got this. Inside the Suburban, Brian turns away from the scene outside the back window, coughs, and feels his gut rising at the nauseating sounds penetrating the sealed interior of the Suburban. He stifles the urge to vomit. He reaches down and gently puts his hands around Penny's ears, a gesture which sadly is becoming a routine. In the front seat, Nick can't tear his eyes from the carnage behind him. On Nick's face, Brian can see a weird mixture of repulsion and admiration, a kind of thank God he's on our side type of awe, but it only serves to tighten Brian's gut. He will not throw up, goddammit. He will be strong for Penny. Brian slips down on the floor and holds the girl close to him. The child is limp and damp. Brian's brain swims with confusion. His brother is everything to him. His brother is the key. But something is happening to Philip, something horrible, and it's beginning to gnaw at Brian. What are the rules? These walking abominations deserve every fucking thing Philip is dishing out, but what are the rules of engagement? Brian is trying to put these thoughts out of his mind when he realizes the killing noises have ceased. Then he hears the heavy footsteps of a person outside the driver's side door. The door clicks. Philip Blake slips back inside the Suburban, dropping the bloody hand axes on the floor in front of Nick. "There'll be more of them," he says, still winded, his face beaded with perspiration. "The gunshot woke him up." Nick peers out the back window at the battlefield of bodies visible in the firelight on the slope, his voice coming out in a monotone, a combination of awe and disgust. "Home run, man. Grand slam home run." "We gotta get out of here," Philip says, wiping a pearl of sweat from his nose, catching his breath, and glancing up at the rearview mirror, searching for Penny in the shadows of the back seat, as if he doesn't even hear Nick. Brian speaks up. "What's the plan, Philip?"
"We gotta find a safe place to stay for the night."
Nick looks at Philip.
"What do you mean, exactly? You mean other than the Suburban?"
"It's too dangerous out here in the dark."
"Yeah, but we'll push it out of the mud in the morning."
"Yeah, but what about grab whatever you need for the night?"
Philip says, reaching for the Ruger.
"Wait!"
Nick grabs Philip's arm.
"You talking about leaving the car? Leaving all our shit out here?"
"Just for the night, come on,"
Philip says, opening his door and climbing out. Brian lets out a sigh and looks up at Nick.
"Shut up and help me with the backpacks."
They camp that night about a quarter of a mile west of the overturned tanker, inside an abandoned yellow school bus, which sits on the shoulder, well illuminated by the cold glow of a sodium vapor light. The bus is still fairly warm and dry, and it's high enough off the pavement to give them good sight lines on the woods on either side of the interstate. It has two doors, one in the front and one off the rear, for easy escape. Plus, the bench seats are padded and long enough for each of them to stretch out for some semblance of rest. The keys are still in the ignition, and the battery still has juice. Inside the bus, it smells like the inside of a stale lunchbox. The ghosts of sweaty, rambunctious kids with their wet mittens and body odors lingering in the fusty air. They eat some spam and some sardines and some expensive pita crackers that were probably meant to adorn party trays at golf outings. They use flashlights, careful not to shine them off the windows. And eventually they spread their sleeping bags on the bench seats for some shut-eye, or at least some facsimile of sleep. They each take turns sitting watch in the cab with one of the Marlins, using the huge side mirrors for unobstructed views of the bus's rear end. Nick takes the first shift and tries unsuccessfully for nearly an hour to raise a station on his portable weather radio. The world is shut down, but at least this section of Interstate 20 is equally still. The edges of the woods remain quiet. When it's Brian's turn to sit watch, up to this point he's only managed a few minutes of fitful dozing on a squeaky bench seat in back, he gladly takes his place in the cab with all the levers and dangling pine tree air fresheners and the laminated photograph of some long-lost driver's baby son. Not that Brian is very comfortable with the prospects of being the only one awake, or for that matter having to fire the goose gun. Still, he needs some time to think. At some point just before dawn, Brian hears Penny's breathing, just barely audible over the faint whistle of the wind through the ranks of sliding windows, become erratic and hyperventilated. The child has been dozing a few seats away from the cab next to her father. Now the little girl sits up with a silent gasp.
Oh, I got it. I mean...
Her voice is barely a whisper.
I got it, I think.
Shh, Brian says, rising from his seat, creeping back down the cabin to the little girl, whispering,
It's okay, kiddo. Uncle Brian's here. It's okay.
Shh, let's not wake your dad. Brian glances over at Philip, who's tangled in a blanket, his face contorted with troubling dreams. He took half a pint of brandy before bed to knock himself out.
I'm okay,
Penny utters in her mousy little voice, looking down at the stuffed penguin in her small hands, squeezing it like a talisman. The thing is soiled and threadbare, and it breaks Brian's heart. Bad dreams? Penny nods. Brian looks at her and thinks it over.
Got an idea, he whispers. Why don't you come up and keep me company for a while?
The little girl nods. He helps her up and then, draping a blanket around her and taking her hand, he silently leads her back up to the cab. He flips down a little jump seat next to the driver's perch and says,
There you go.
He pats the worn upholstery.
You can be my co-pilot.
Penny settles into the seat with her blanket pulled tightly around her and the penguin.
See that?
Brian points to a filthy little video monitor above the dash, about the size of a paperback book, on which a grainy black-and-white image reveals the highway behind them. The wind rustles through the trees, the sodium lights gleaming off the roofs of wrecked cars.
That's a security camera, for backing up, see?
The girl sees it.
We're safe here, kiddo,
Brian says as convincingly as possible. Earlier in his shift, he had figured out a way to turn the ignition key to the accessory position, lighting up the dash like an old pinball machine coming to life.
Everything's under control.
The girl nods.
You want to tell me about it?
Brian says softly a moment later. Penny looks confused.
Tell you about what? The bad dream. Sometimes it helps to, like, tell someone, you know. Makes it go away. Poof.
Penny gives him a feeble little shrug.
I dreamed I got sick.
Sick like those people out there?
Yes.
Brian takes a long, anguished, deep breath.
Listen to me, kiddo. Whatever these people have, you are not going to catch it. Do you understand? Your daddy will not let that happen. Never in a million years. I will not let that happen.
She nods.
You are very important to your daddy. You're very important to me.
Brian feels an unexpected hitch in his chest. A catching of his words. A burning sensation in his eyes. For the first time since he departed his parents' place over a week and a half ago, he realizes how deeply his feelings go for this little girl.
I got an idea, he says after getting his emotions in check. Do you know what a code word is?
Penny looks at him.
Like a secret code?
Exactly. Brian licks his finger and then wipes a stain of dirt from her cheek.
You and I are going to have this secret code word.
Okay.
Now, this is a very special code, okay? From now on, Whenever I say this secret word, I want you to do something for me. Can you do that? Can you, like, always remember to do something for me whenever I give you the secret code word? Sure, I guess. Whenever I say the code word, I want you to hide your eyes. Hide my eyes? Yeah, and cover your ears until I tell you it's okay to look, all right? And there's one more thing. Okay. Whenever I give you the secret code, I want you to remember something. What? I want you to remember that there's gonna come a day when you won't have to hide your eyes anymore. There's gonna come a day when everything's all better, and there won't be any more sick people. Got that? She nods. Got it. Now, what's the word gonna be? You want me to pick it? You bet. It's your secret code. You should pick it. The little girl wrinkles up her nose as she ponders a suitable word. The sight of her contemplating, so intently that she looks as though she's calculating the Pythagorean theorem, presses down on Brian's heart. Finally, the child looks up at Brian, and for the first time since the plague had begun, a glimmer of hope kindles in her enormous eyes. I got it. She whispers the word to her stuffed animal, then looks up. Penguin likes it. Great. Don't keep me in suspense. Away, she says. The secret code word's gonna be away. The gray dawn comes in stages. First, an eerie calm settles around the interstate, the wind dying in the trees, and then a luminous pale glow around the edges of the forest wakes everybody up and gets them going. The sense of urgency is almost immediate. They feel naked and exposed without their vehicle, so everybody concentrates on the task at hand, packing up, getting back to the Suburban, and getting the damn thing unstuck. They make the quarter-mile hike back to the SUV in 15 minutes, carrying their bedrolls and excess food in backpacks. They encounter a single zombie on the way, a wandering teenage girl, and Philip easily puts out her lights by quickly and quietly chopping a furrow into her skull, while Brian whispers the secret word to Penny. When they reach the Suburban, they work in silence, ever mindful of the shadows of adjacent woods. First, they try to apply weight to the rear end by putting Nick and Philip on the tailgate and having Brian give it gas from the driver's seat, pushing with one leg outside the door. It doesn't work. Then they search the immediate area for something to build traction under the wheels. It takes them an hour, but they eventually unearth a couple of broken pallets scattered along a drainage ditch, and they bring them back and wedge them under the wheels. This also fails. Somehow, the mud beneath the SUV is so saturated with moisture and runoff and oil and God knows what else that it just keeps sucking the vehicle deeper, the leaning Suburban slipping progressively backward down the slope. But they refuse to give up. Driven by a relentless anxiety over unexplained noises in the adjacent pine forest, twigs snapping, low concussive booms in the distance, as well as the constant unspoken dread of having all their worldly possessions and supplies lost with the foundering Suburban, nobody is willing to face the encroaching hopelessness of the situation. By mid-afternoon, after working for hours and breaking for lunch, and then going back at it for a couple more hours, all they've succeeded in doing is causing the SUV to drift nearly 6 feet farther down the muddy incline, while Penny sits inside the vehicle, alternately playing with Penguin and pressing her morose face to the window. At that point, Philip steps back from the mud pit and gazes at the western horizon. The overcast sky has begun its fade toward dusk, and the prospect of nightfall suddenly puts a pinch on Philip's gut. Covered with sludge, soaked in sweat, he pulls a bandana and wipes his neck. He starts to say something when another series of noises from the neighboring trees yank his attention to the south. For hours now, the crackling, snapping noises, maybe footsteps, maybe not, have been getting closer. Nick and Brian,
both wiping their hands with rags, joined Philip. None of them says anything for a moment. Each of their expressions reflects the hard reality, and when another snap from the trees crackles, as loud as a pistol shot, Nick speaks up.
Writing's on the wall, ain't it?
Philip shoves his handkerchief back in his pocket.
Knot's gonna fall soon.
What do you think, Philly?
Time for Plan B.
Brian swallows hard, looking at his brother.
I wasn't aware there was a Plan B.
Philip gazes at his brother, and for a moment, Philip feels a bizarre mixture of anger, pity, impatience, and affection. Then Philip looks at the old, rust-pocked Suburban and feels a twinge of melancholy, as though he's about to say goodbye to another old friend.
There is now.
They siphon gas from the Suburban into plastic tanks they brought from Wiltshire. Then they get lucky enough to find a big, late-model Buick LeSabre, the keys still in it, left for dead on the side of the road about an eighth of a mile west of there. They commandeer the Buick and roar back to the foundered SUV. They fill the Buick with gas and transfer as many supplies as they can squeeze into the car's huge trunk. Then they take off toward the setting sun, each of them glancing back at the swamped SUV, receding into the distance like a shipwreck sinking into oblivion. Indications of the looming apocalypse appear on either side of the interstate with alarming frequency now. As they draw nearer and nearer to the city, weaving with increasing difficulty through abandoned wreckage, the trees thinning and giving way to a growing number of residential enclaves, shopping plazas, and office parks, the telltale signs of doom are everywhere. They pass a dark, deserted Walmart, the windows broken, a sea of clothes and merchandise strewn across the parking lot. They notice more and more power outages, entire communities as dark and silent as tombs. They pass strip malls ravaged by looting, biblical warnings scrawled on exhaust chimneys. They even see a small single-engine plane, tangled in a giant electrical tower still smoking. Somewhere between Lithonia and Panthersville, the Buick's rear end starts vibrating like a son of a bitch, and Philip realizes the thing is two blown tires. Maybe they were already flat when they acquired the car, who knows? But there's no time to try and fix the infernal things, and no time to debate the matter. Night is pressing in again, and the closer they get to the outskirts of Metro Atlanta, the more the roads are knotted with the carcasses of mangled wrecks and abandoned cars. Nobody says it out loud, but they're all beginning to wonder whether they could get into the city faster on foot. Even the neighboring two lanes, like Hillendale and Farrington, are blocked with empty cars, lined up like fallen dominoes in the middle of the road. At this rate, it'll take them a week to get into town. Which is why Philip makes the executive decision at that point to leave the Buick where it sits, pack up every last thing they can possibly carry, and set out on foot. Nobody's crazy about the idea, but they go along with it. The alternative of searching the frozen traffic jam in the pitch darkness for spare tires or a suitable replacement vehicle doesn't seem viable right now. They quickly dig their necessities out of the Buick's trunk, stuffing duffel bags and backpacks with supplies, blankets, food, weapons, and water. They're getting better at communicating with whispers, hand gestures, and nods, hyper-aware now of the distant drone of dead people, the sound waxing and waning in the darkness beyond the highway, percolating in the trees and behind buildings. Philip has the strongest back, so he takes the largest canvas duffel. Nick and Brian each strap on an overloaded backpack. Even Penny agrees to carry a knapsack filled with bedding. Philip takes the Ruger pistol, the two bad axes, one shoved down each side of his belt, and a long machete-like tool for cutting underbrush, which he shoves down the length of his spine between the duffel and his stained chambray shirt. Brian and Nick each cradle a Marlin 55 shotgun in their arms, as well as a pickaxe strapped to the sides of their respective backpacks. They start walking west, and this time, not a single one of them looks back. A quarter of a mile down the road, they encounter an overpass clogged with a battered Airstream mobile home. Its cab is wrapped around a telephone pole. All the street lights have flickered out, and in the full dark, a muffled banging noise is heard inside the walls of the ruined trailer. This makes everybody pause suddenly on the shoulder beneath the viaduct.
Jesus, it could be somebody...
Brian stops himself when he sees his brother's hand shoot up.
Shh! But what if it's quiet?
Philip cocks his head and listens. His expression is that of a cold stone monument.
This way. Come on.
Philip leads the group down a rocky slope on the north edge of the interchange, each of them descending the hill gingerly, careful not to slip on the wet pea gravel. Brian brings up the rear, wondering again about the rules, wondering if they just deserted one of their fellow human beings. His thoughts are quickly subsumed by the plunge into the darker territory of countryside. They follow a narrow blacktop two-lane called Miller Road northward through the darkness. For about a mile, they encounter nothing more than a sparsely commercialized area of desolate industrial parks and foundries, their signs as dark as hieroglyphs on cave walls. Barlow World Handling, Atlas Tool and Die, Hughes Supply, Simcast Electronics, Peachtree Steel. The rhythmic shuffle of their footsteps on the cold asphalt mingles with the thrumming of their breaths. The silence starts working on their nerves. Penny is getting tired. They hear rustling noises in the woods off to their immediate right. At last, Philip raises his hand and points toward a sprawling, low-slung plant stretching back into the distance.
"This place'll do," he says in a low, flat whisper.
"Do for what?"
Nick says, pausing next to Philip, breathing hard.
"For the night," Philip says. There is no emotion in his voice.
He leads the group past a low, unlighted sign that says, Georgia Pacific Corporation. Philip gets in through the office window. He has everybody huddle in the shadows outside the entrance, while he makes his way through empty, littered corridors toward the warehouse in the center of the building. The place is as dark as a crypt. Philip's heart beats in his ears as he strides along with the bad axes at his side. He tries one of the light switches, to no avail. He barely notices the pungent aroma of wood pulp permeating the air, a gluey, sappy odor. And when he reaches the safety doors, he slowly shoves them open with the toe of his boot. The warehouse is the size of an airplane hangar, with giant gantries hanging overhead, the rows of huge scoop lights dark, the odor of paper must as thick as talc. Thin moonlight shines down through gargantuan sky windows. The floor is sectioned off into rows of enormous paper rolls, as big around as redwood trunks, so white they seem to glow in the darkness. Something moves in the middle distance. Philip shoves the bad axes down either side of his belt, then grasps the hilt of the Ruger. He draws out the gun, snaps back the slide, and raises the muzzle at a dark figure staggering out from behind a stack of pallets. The factory rat comes through the shadows toward Philip slowly, hungrily. The front of his dungarees dark with dried blood and bile. His long, slack face full of teeth gleaming in the moonbeams coming through the skylight. One shot puts the dead thing down, the blast bouncing back like a kettle drum in the cavernous warehouse. Philip makes a sweep of the remaining length of the warehouse. He finds a couple more of them, an older fat man, a former night watchman from the looks of his soiled uniform, and a younger one, each dragging his dead ass out from behind shelving units. Philip feels nothing as he pops each one in the skull at point-blank range. On his way back toward the front entrance, he discovers a fourth one in the shadows, caught between two massive paper rolls. The bottom half of the former forklift operator is wedged between the blinding white cylinders, crushed beyond recognition. All his fluids pooled and dried on the cement floor beneath him. The top half of the creature convulses and flails, its milkstone eyes stupidly awake.
"What's up, Bubba?" Philip says as he approaches with the gun at his hip.
Another day, another dollar, huh?
The zombie chomps impotently at the air between its face and Philip.
Lunch break overdue?
Chomp.
Eat this.
The .22 caliber blast echoes as the slug smashes through the forklift operator's orbital bone, turning the milky eye black and sending a chunk of the parietal hemisphere flying. The spray, a mixture of blood, tissue, and cerebrospinal fluid, spatters the rows of pristine white paper as the top half of the dead thing wilts like a noodle. Philip admires his work of art, the scarlet tendrils on that field of heavenly white, for quite a long time before going to get the others. Chapter 7. They spend the night in a glass-encased foreman's office, high above the main floor of the Georgia-Pacific warehouse. They use their battery-powered lanterns and they move the desks and chairs aside, and they spread their bedrolls on the linoleum tiles. The previous occupant must have practically lived in the little 200-square-foot crow's nest, because there are CDs, a stereo, a microwave, a small refrigerator, the food inside it mostly spoiled, drawers full of candy bars, work orders, half-full liquor bottles, office supplies, fresh shirts, cigarettes, check stubs, and porn. Philip hardly says a word the whole night. He just sits near the window overlooking the warehouse floor, occasionally taking a swig of whiskey from the pint bottle he found in the desk, while Nick sits on the floor in the opposite corner, silently reading a small concordance Bible by the light of a lantern. Nick claims he carries the little dog-eared, leather-bound book wherever he goes, but the others have rarely seen him reading it, until now. Brian forces down some tuna fish and saltine crackers, and he tries to get Penny to eat something, but she won't. She seems to be drawing further into herself, her eyes now displaying a permanent glaze that looks vaguely catatonic to Brian. Later, Brian sleeps next to her, while Philip dozes in the swivel chair by the greasy wire mesh window, through which past foremen have kept their eyes peeled for loafers. This is the first time Brian has seen his brother too consumed by his own thoughts to sleep next to his daughter, and it does not bode well. The next morning they awaken to the sounds of dogs barking somewhere outside. The dull, pale light floods in through the high windows, and they pack quickly. Nobody has any appetite for breakfast, so they use the bathroom, tape their feet to ward against blisters, and put on extra socks. Brian's heels are already sore from the few miles they've trekked, and there's no telling how far they'll go today. They each have one change of clothes, but nobody has the energy to put on anything clean. On their way out, each of them, except Philip, studiously avoids looking at the bodies lying in pools of gore in the warehouse. Philip seems galvanized by the sight of corpses illuminated by daylight. Outside, they discover the source of the barking. About 100 yards west of the warehouse, a pack of strays, mostly mutts, are fighting over something pink and ragged on the ground. As Philip and the others approach, the dogs scatter, leaving the object of their attentions in the mud. Brian identifies the object as they pass and softly gives Penny the code word. Away. The thing is a severed human arm, chewed so badly it looks like it belongs to a wet rag doll. Don't look, pumpkin, Philip mutters to his daughter, and Brian pulls Penny next to him, covering the girl's eyes. They trudge westward, moving silently, their footsteps furtive and careful like thieves creeping through the morning sun. They follow a road called Snapfinger Drive, which runs parallel to the interstate. The black top ribbon winds through barren forest preserves, abandoned residential villages, and ransacked strip malls. As they move through increasingly populated areas, the side of the road holds horrors that no little girl should ever see. A high school football field is strewn with headless torsos. A mortuary has been hastily boarded and nailed shut from the outside, the horrible muffled sounds of the recently risen scratching and clawing to get out. Philip fervidly searches for a suitable vehicle to hijack, but most of the cars along Snapfinger lie in ditches like burned husks, or sit on the gravel shoulder with two or three tires blown. Traffic lights, most of them either blinking yellow or completely black, hang over clogged intersections. The highway, visible up along a ridge 100 yards to their left, crawls with the dead. Every so often the tattered remains of a person will cross through the distant pale rays of the rising sun, causing Philip to motion for everybody to get the hell down and stay quiet. But despite the arduous process of ducking behind trees or wreckage every time they sense another presence looming nearby, they cover quite a bit of ground that day. They encounter no other survivors. Late that afternoon, the weather turns clear and sunny. Ironically, a fine early autumn afternoon in any other context, the temperature in the low 60s. By 5 o'clock, the men are sweating, and Penny has tied her sweatshirt around her waist. Philip calculates their progress, subtracting a 30-minute rest for lunch, and he figures that they've averaged about 1 mile an hour, crossing nearly 8 miles of suburban wilderness. Still, none of them realizes how close they are to the city until they come upon a muddy hillock rising out of the pines just west of Glenwood, where a Baptist church sits on a ridge, smoldering from a recent conflagration, its steeple a smoking ruin. Exhausted, drained, and hungry, they follow the winding road up the grade to the top of the hill, and when they reach the church parking lot, they all stand there for a moment, gazing out at the western horizon, frozen with a sort of unexpected awe. The skyline, only 3 miles away, looks almost radiant in the fading light. For boys growing up within a couple 100 miles of the great capital of the New South, Philip and Brian Blake have spent precious little time in Atlanta. For the 2.5 years that he drove trucks for Harlow Electric, Philip occasionally made deliveries there, and Brian has seen a share of concerts at the Civic Center, the Earl, the Georgia Dome, and the Fox Theater, but neither man knows the town well. As they stand on the edge of that church parking lot, with the acrid smell of the apocalypse in their sinuses, the skyline and the hazy distance reflects back at them a sort of unattainable grandeur. In the dreamy light, they can see the Capitol spire with its golden-clad dome, the mirrored monoliths of the concourse complex, the massive Peachtree Plaza towers, and the pinnacle of the Atlantic building. But it all seems to give off an air of mirage, a sort of lost city of Atlantis feeling. Brian is about to say something about the place being so close and yet so far, or perhaps make a comment about the unknowable condition of the streets down below, when he sees a blur out of the corner of his eye.
Look!
Penny has darted away, unexpectedly and quickly, her voice shrill with excitement.
Penny!
Brian starts after the little girl, who is scurrying across the western edge of the church parking lot.
Grab her!
Philip calls out, chasing after Brian, who is charging after the girl.
Look it! Look it!
Penny's little legs are churning frantically as she darts towards a side street, which winds along the far side of the hill.
It's a policeman!
She points as she runs.
He'll save us!
Penny, stop! The little girl scurries around an exit gate and down the side road.
He'll save us!
Brian clears the end of the fence at a dead run, and he sees a squad car about 50 yards away, parked on the side of the road under a massive live oak. Penny is approaching the royal blue Crown Victoria, the Atlanta police decal on the door, the trademark red swoosh, and the light bar mounted on the roof. A silhouette hunched behind the wheel.
Stop, honey!
Brian sees Penny pausing suddenly outside the driver's door, panting with exertion, staring into the man behind the wheel. By this point, Philip and Nick have caught up with Brian, and Philip zooms past his brother. He charges up to his little girl and scoops her off the ground as though pulling her out of a fire. Brian reaches the squad car and looks in the half-open driver's side window. The patrolman was once a heavy-set white man with long sideburns. Nobody says anything. from her father's arms. Penny gapes through the car window at the dead man in uniform straining against his shoulder strap. From the looks of his badge and his garb, as well as the word traffic emblazoned on the front quarter panel of the vehicle, he was once a low-level officer, probably assigned to the outer regions of the city, feeding stray cars to the impound lots along Fayetteville Road. Now the man twists in his seat. Imprisoned by a seatbelt he can't fathom, open-mouthed and drooling at the fresh meat outside his window. His facial features are deformed and bloated, the color of mildew. His eyes like tarnished coins. He snarls at the humans, snapping his blackened teeth with feral appetite. "Now that's just plain pathetic," Philip says to no one particular.
"I'll take her,"
Brian says, stepping closer and reaching for Penny. The dead cop, catching the smell of food, snaps his jaws toward Brian, straining the belt, making the canvas harness creak. Brian jerks back with a start.
"He can't hurt you," Philip says in a low, alarmingly casual tone. "He can't even figure out the goddamn seatbelt."
"You're kidding me,"
Nick says, looking over Philip's shoulder.
"Poor dumb son of a bitch."
The dead cop growls. Penny climbs into Brian's arms and Brian steps back, holding the child tightly.
"Come on, Philip. Let's go."
"Wait a minute. Hold your horses."
Philip pulls the .22 from the back of his belt.
"Come on, man,"
Nick pipes in.
"The noise is gonna draw more of them. Let's get out of here."
Philip points the gun at the cop, who grows still at the sight of the muzzle. But Philip doesn't pull the trigger. He simply smiles and makes a childlike shooting noise.
Psh, psh, psh. "Philip, come on,"
Brian says, shifting Penny's weight in his arms.
"That thing doesn't even..."
Brian stops and stares. The dead cop is transfixed by the sight of that Ruger in his face. Brian wonders if his rudimentary central nervous system is somehow sending a signal to some far-off muscle memory buried deep in his dead brain cells. His expression changes. The monstrous abomination of a face falls like a rotten souffle, and the thing almost looks sad. Or maybe even scared. It's hard to tell behind that beastly snarling mouth and mask of necrotic tissue, but something in those buffalo nickel eyes flickers then. A trace of dread? An unexpected tide of emotion rises in Brian Blake, and it takes him by surprise. It's hard to put a name to it. It's partly repulsion, partly pity, partly disgust, partly sorrow, and partly rage. He suddenly puts Penny down, and he gently turns her around so that she's facing the church. "This is an away moment, kiddo," Brian says softly, and then turns to face his brother. Philip is taunting the zombie.
"Just relax and follow the bouncing ball," he says to the drooling creature, waving the barrel slowly back and forth.
"I'll do it," Brian says.
Philip freezes. He turns and gives his brother a look.
"Say what?"
"Give me the gun. I'll finish it off."
Philip looks at Nick, and Nick looks at Brian.
"Hey, man, you don't want to give me the gun."
The smile that twitches at the corners of Philip's lips is complex and humorless.
"Be my guest, sport."
Brian takes the gun and without hesitation steps forward, pokes it in the car, presses the muzzle against the dead cop's head, and starts to squeeze off a single shot. But his finger will not respond. His trigger finger will not obey the command his brain is giving it. In the awkward pause, the zombie drools as though waiting for something.
"Give me the gun back, sport."
Philip's voice sounds far away to Brian.
"No. I got this one."
Brian grits his teeth and tries to pull the trigger. His finger is a block of ice. His eyes burn. His stomach clenches. The dead cop snarls. Brian begins to tremble as Philip steps forward.
Give me the gun back.
No!
Come on, sport. Give it back.
I got it!
Brian wipes his eyes with his sleeve.
Damn it, I got it!
Come on.
Philip reaches for the gun.
Enough.
God damn it!
Brian says, lowering the gun, the tears welling in his eyes.
He can't do it. He might as well face it.
He gives the gun to his brother and steps back with his head lowered. Philip puts the policeman out of his misery with a single pop that sends a spray of blood mist across the inside of the prowler's windshield. The bark echoes up and out over the ruined landscape. The dead cop slumps over the wheel. A long moment passes as Brian fights his tears and tries to hide his trembling. He gazes through the car window at the cop's remains. He feels like saying he's sorry to the dead officer, but decides against it. He just keeps staring at the limp body, still held in place by the shoulder strap. The faint sound of a child's voice, like the flutter of broken wings, comes from behind them.
Dad? Uncle Brian? Uncle Nick? Something bad is happening.
The three men whirl around almost simultaneously. Their gazes rise across the church parking lot to the place toward which Penny is staring and pointing.
Son of a bitch,
Philip says, seeing the worst-case scenario unfolding before his very eyes.
Oh, my God,
Nick says.
Shit, shit, shit!
Brian feels his spine go cold as he sees the front of the church.
Come on, Pumpkin, this way.
Philip goes over to the child and tugs her gently back toward the cruiser.
We're going to borrow this nice policeman's car.
He reaches inside the driver's door, unlatches it, kicks it open, unsnaps the seatbelt, and yanks the limp body from the vehicle, the zombie sprawling to the pavement with the ceremonial splat of an overripe gourd.
Everybody in. Quick, throw your shit in the back and get in.
Brian and Nick circle around to the other side, throw open the doors, toss in their backpacks, and get in. Philip slides Penny over the center hump, setting her on the passenger seat and climbing behind the wheel. The keys are in the ignition. Philip turns the key. The engine ticks. The dashboard barely lights. Just a dull ember of power left.
Damn it to hell! Damn it!
Philip glances out the window at the church.
Okay, wait a minute.
Wait, wait! He shoots a quick glance through the windshield, and he sees that the road ahead banks into a steep downgrade, which leads under a train trestle. He looks at Brian and Nick.
You two, get out, now!
Brian and Nick look at each other stunned. What they see emerging from the church, most likely aroused by the commotion of voices and the pistol shot, would most likely burn itself into their memories for some time to come. Unfortunately, it would also linger in Penny's imagination, probably more vividly. Dead things materializing behind gaping holes in stained glass portals and half-open doorways, some of them still clad in ragged, blood-soaked clerical vestments, some of them in Sunday go-to-meeting suits and crepe dresses drenched with gore. Some of them are gnawing on severed human appendages, while others carry body parts at their sides, the organs still dripping from the gruesome orgy inside the chapel. There are at least 50, maybe more, and they move side by side with a lurching purpose toward the police car. For a single instant, before throwing open his door and joining Nick outside the car, Brian finds his mind flashing on a strange thought.
They're moving as one. Even in death, still a tightly knit congregation, like puppets of some great overmind.
But the notion quickly flies from his thought as he hears the call of his brother from behind the wheel of the cop car.
Push the son of a bitch with everything you got and then hop on!
Now Brian joins Nick behind the car and then, without really even thinking about it, begins to push. By this point, Philip has jammed the thing into neutral and has his door open, and his leg outside the car and is shoving the thing with his boot with all his might. It takes them a few moments to build up steam, the church-going horde behind them approaching steadily, dropping their ghastly treasures amid the promise of fresh meat. But soon the cruiser is coasting rapidly down the hill, faster and faster, to the point where Brian and Nick have to hop on board. Nick grasps the whip antenna for purchase. Brian gets halfway inside the flapping rear door, but can't get himself the rest of the way inside without falling, so he holds tightly to the door's frame. By this point, the car is halfway down the hill, putting distance between them and the scores of undead shambling after them. The weight of the vehicle is building inertia. The Crown Victoria now feels as though it's a runaway train, bumping down the cracked pavement toward the intersection at the bottom of the hill. The wind whips Brian's dark hair as he holds on for dear life. Nick hollers something, but the noise of the wind and the thumping wheels drown out his voice. At the bottom of the hill lies a defunct Conrail switchyard, its maze of ancient rails fossilized into the Georgia earth, its ramshackle sheds and office buildings as black and decayed as prehistoric ruins. Philip is yelling something that Brian can't hear. They reach the bottom of the hill and the steering wheel locks up. The squad car bangs over the track and careens into the switchyard. Philip can't turn the wheel. The car skids. The wheels cut into the cinders, the undercarriage sparking off the iron. Brian and Nick hold on tight as the cruiser scuds to a halt in a cloud of black dust.
Grab your shit. Everybody, now!
Philip already has his door open, and he's already pulling Penny out. Brian and Nick hop off the rear end and join Philip, who hefts his duffel onto one shoulder and lifts his daughter onto the other.
This way!
He nods toward a narrow street to the west. They hurry out of the switchyard. A row of boarded storefronts and burned-out buildings stretches down a perpendicular cobblestone road. They move quickly along, staying tight under a row of awnings on the south side of the street, their shoulders brushing graffiti-stained doors and rust-oleum-flecked windows. The dusk is closing in, and shadows are lengthening, burying them in gloom. The sense of being surrounded is overwhelming. Although at the moment they don't see any creatures, just a long corridor of shitty, obsolete businesses once serving this corroded, forsaken part of Atlanta's outskirts. Pawn shops, currency exchanges, bail bondsmen, auto parts places, taverns, and junk shops. As they move along the scarred storefronts, huffing and puffing with the weight of their loads, not daring to speak or make any unnecessary noise, the urgency of getting inside somewhere begins to work on them. Night is falling again, and this place will be the dark side of the moon in less than an hour. They have no maps, no GPS, no compass, no sense of where they are other than the misty landmark of the skyline miles to the west. Brian feels the anxiety on the back of his neck like a cold finger. They turn a corner. Brian sees the mechanic shop first, but Philip sees it a split second later and motions toward it with a nod.
Up there in the corner, see it?
Nick sees it now.
Yeah. Yeah. Looks good.
It does indeed look good. On the southwest corner of a deserted intersection one block away, Don Levy's Auto Body and Repair appears to be the only business in this godforsaken area that has any life still in it, although it currently appears closed for the season. They hasten toward the building. As they approach, they see that the half-acre lot is recently repaved. The two islands of gas pumps out front, clean and apparently operational, sit under a giant chevron sign. The building itself, lined with columns of new tires fronted on one side by a pair of massive double garage doors, is a gleaming slab of silver metal siding and reinforced glass. There's even a second floor, housing either an office or more retail space. Philip leads them around back. The rear of the place is tidy, with newly painted garbage dumpsters shoved up against the cinder block back wall. They search for a door or window, but find neither.
What about the front door?
Brian says in a breathless whisper as they pause next to the dumpsters. They can hear the congregation coming down the street, the shuffling, groaning chorus of 50-plus zombies.
I'm sure it's locked, Philip says,
his gaunt, hard face shiny from the labors of carrying his daughter and his duffel. Penny is compulsively, nervously sucking her thumb against his shoulder.
How do you know?
Philip shrugs.
Guess it's worth a try.
They creep around the far side of the building and they stay in the shadows under the chevron awning as Philip sets Penny and the duffel down and hurries up to the entrance door. He yanks the handle. It's open. Chapter 8. They huddle for some time inside the repair center's front office, under the cashier's counter, next to a spinner rack of candy bars and potato chips. Philip locks the door and crouches next to the others in the shadows, watching the parade of undead out on the street, passing by the shop, oblivious to the whereabouts of their prey, stupidly scanning with their button eyes like dogs hearing high-pitched whistles. From this vantage point, gazing through the meshed reinforced windows, Brian gets a chance to scrutinize the dead clergy and ragged parishioners as they awkwardly promenade past the service station. How did this church full of true believers turn en masse? Did they gather as frightened Christians after the plague had broken out, cleaving to each other for succor and comfort? Did they hear fire and brimstone sermons from the preachers about the revelation to John? Did the pastors furiously cant warning parables? And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. And how did the first one turn? Was it somebody in a back pew having a heart attack? Was it a ritual suicide? Brian imagines one of those old black ladies, her system clogged with cholesterol, her plump, gloved hands waving with the spirit, suddenly clutching her massive bosom at the first twinge of coronary. And minutes later, maybe in an hour or so, the woman rises, her porcine face full of a new religion, a singular, savage faith. "Fucking holy rollers," Philip grumbles from across the cashier's counter. Then he turns to Penny and swallows contritely. "Sorry for the language, pumpkin." They explore the repair center. The place is spotless and secure, cold but clean. The floor swept, the shelves well-ordered, the cool air redolent with the odors of new rubber and the vaguely pleasant chemical fragrance of fuels and fluids. They realize they can stay here for the night. But it is not until they investigate the large repair garage that they make their most fortuitous discovery. "Holy crap! It's a tank," Brian says, standing on the cold cement, shining a flashlight at the black beauty parked under canvas tarps in one corner. The others gather around the sole vehicle standing in the darkness. Philip whips off the tarp. It's a late-model Cadillac Escalade in cherry condition, its onyx finish gleaming in the yellow light. "Probably belonged to the owner," Nick ventures. "Christmas comes early," Philip says, kicking one of the massive tires with his muddy work boot. The luxury SUV is enormous, with huge molded bumpers, giant vertical headlights, and big shiny chrome wheels. It looks like the kind of vehicle a secret government agency would have in its fleet, the sinister tinted windows reflecting the bloom of the flashlight back at them. "There's nobody inside it, right?" Brian shines the beam off the opaque glass. Philip pulls the .22 from his belt, clicks a door open, and points the muzzle in at the empty showroom-clean interior with its wood trim, leather seats, and console that looks like a control center for an airliner. Philip says, "Bet you a dollar to a donut there's keys in a drawer somewhere." The whole incident with the cop in the church seems to have pushed Penny into a deeper stupor. She sleeps that night curled into a fetal ball on the floor of the repair area, covered in blankets, her thumb in her mouth. "Haven't seen her do that in a coon's age," Philip remarks nearby, sitting on his bedroll with the last of the whiskey. He wears a sleeveless t-shirt and filthy jeans, his boots sitting next to him. He takes a sip and wipes his mouth.
"Do what?"
Brian is sitting cross-legged, bundled in his blood-splattered coat, on the other side of the little girl, careful not to speak too loudly. Nick dozes over by a workbench, zipped in a sleeping bag. The temperature has plunged into the 40s.
"Soak her thumb like that," Philip says. "She's dealing with a lot."
"We all are."
"Yeah."
Brian stares into his lap.
"We'll make it, though."
"Make it where?" Brian looks up. The refugee center. Wherever it is, we'll find it. Yeah, sure.
Philip kills the rest of the bottle and sets it down.
We'll find the place. And the sun'll come out tomorrow and all the orphans will find good homes and the Braves will win the fucking pennant.
Something bothering you?
Philip shakes his head. Jesus Christ, Brian, open your eyes.
Are you mad at me?
Philip stands and stretches his sore neck. Now why the fuck would I be mad at you, sport? It's business as usual, no big deal.
What does that mean?
Nothing. Just get some sleep.
Philip walks over to the Escalade, kneels down, and looks under the chassis for something.
Brian climbs to his feet, his heart racing. He feels dizzy. His sore throat is better, and he stopped coughing after a few days of rest and rejuvenation in the wheelchair house. But he still doesn't feel 100%.
Who does?
He goes over and stands behind his brother.
What do you mean by business as usual?
It is what it is, Philip mutters, checking the SUV's underbelly.
You're mad about the cop, Brian says.
Philip stands up slowly, turns, and comes face to face with his brother.
I said go to sleep.
Maybe I have a harder time shooting something that was once human. So sue me. Philip grabs Brian by the nape of the t-shirt, spins him around, and slams him back against the side of the Escalade. The impact nearly knocks the breath out of Brian, and the noise wakes up Nick, and it even makes Penny stir.
You listen to me,
Philip growls in a threatening, husky voice that's both sober and drunk at the same time.
Next time you take a gun from me, you make sure you're ready to put it to good use. That cop was harmless, but who knows about next time? And I ain't gonna be the one babysitting you with nothing but my gonads in my hand, you understand? You read me?
Brian is nodding, his throat dry with terror.
Yes.
Philip increases the pressure on Brian's shirt.
You better get past your namby-pamby bullshit sheltered life and start carrying your weight around here and stoving some heads in because it sure as hell is gonna get worse before it gets better.
I understand, Brian says.
Philip doesn't let go, his eyes glinting with rage.
We're gonna survive this thing, and we're gonna do it by being bigger monsters than they are, you understand? There ain't no rules anymore. There ain't no philosophy, there ain't no grace, there ain't no mercy. There's only us and them, and all they want to do is eat our ass. So we're gonna fucking eat them. We're gonna chew them up and spit them out. We're gonna survive this thing, or I will blow a hole through this whole fucked up world. You follow me? You follow me?
Brian nods like crazy. Philip lets him go and walks away. By this point, Nick is awake and sitting up and staring agape. Penny's eyes are wide, and she furiously sucks her thumb, watching her father storm across the repair floor. He walks over to the massive reinforced garage doors, pauses, and stares out at the night through the slatted burglar bars, his big, gnarly fists clenched. Across the floor, still pinned against the side of the Escalade, Brian Blake wages a silent battle to keep from crying like a namby-pamby, bullshit-sheltered baby. The next morning, in the lambent daylight filtering into the shop, they hurry through a breakfast of cereal bars and bottled water, and then pour the contents of 3 5-gallon jugs of gas into the Escalade's tank. They find the keys in a drawer in the office, and they pack all their belongings in the SUV's cargo area. The tinted windows are fogged with condensation from the cold. Brian and Penny settle into the back seat, while Nick stands at the garage door awaiting Philip's signal. Since the power is down, seemingly everywhere now, they're forced to spring the manual latch on the automated door opener. Now Philip climbs behind the wheel of the Escalade and fires it up. The huge 6.2-liter V8 hums. The console lights up. Philip jacks it into gear and edges forward, giving Nick the signal. Nick yanks the closest garage door, and the casters squeak as the thing rises on its tracks. The light and air of the day explode through the windshield as Nick hustles around to the passenger side door and climbs into the shotgun seat. The door slams. Philip pauses for a moment, looking down at the dash.
What's the matter?
Nick says in a shaky voice, still a little nervous about questioning anything Philip does.
Shouldn't we maybe get moving?
One second, Philip says, reaching down to a pull-out drawer. Inside a spring-loaded map case, he finds about 2 dozen CDs, neatly organized by the former owner. Calvin R. Donlevy of 601 Green Cove Lane, S.E., according to the registration in the glove box.
Here we go, Philip says, rifling through the discs.
Calvin R. Donlevy of Green Cove Lane is apparently a lover of classic rock, judging by all the Zeppelin, Sabbath, and Hendrix in his collection.
A little something to help with the concentration.
All at once, a Cheap Trick disc goes in, and Philip puts the hammer down. The gravitational thrust of 450 horses pushes them against the seats as the wide-body Escalade blasts off through the opening, barely making it through the gap without sideswiping the metal trusses. Daylight floods the interior. The buzzsaw guitar intro of the party anthem, Hello There, leaps out of the Bose 5.1 surround sound system as they boom across the lot and into the street. Cheap Trick's lead singer asks if all the ladies and gentlemen are ready to rock. Philip roars around the corner and heads north on Maynard Terrace. The street widens. Lower-income homes blur by on either side of the vehicle. A wandering zombie in a torn raincoat looms off to the right, and Philip veers toward the thing. The sickening thump is barely audible above the roar of the engine and the thunderous drumbeats of Cheap Trick. In back, Brian sinks down lower in his seat, feeling sick to his stomach and worrying about Penny. She slumps in her seat next to him, staring straight ahead. Brian reaches over and buckles her in and tries to give her a smile.
Gotta be an entrance ramp north of here, Philip is saying over the noise.
But the sound of his voice is almost completely drowned by the growl of the engine and the music. 2 more walking dead loom off to their left. A man and woman in tatters, maybe homeless people, scuttling along the curb. And Philip happily swerves and takes them both down like soggy bowling pins. A severed ear sticks to the windshield, and Philip puts the wipers on. They reach the north end of Maynard Terrace, the entrance ramp straight ahead. Philip slams the brakes. The Escalade screams to a stop in front of a 6-car pileup at the foot of the ramp, a cluster of upright corpses circling the wreckage like lazy buzzards. Philip snaps the lever into reverse. The pedal goes down, the rock music thundering. The gravitational force sucks everybody forward. Brian braces Penny against her seat. A yank of the wheel and the Escalade does a 180, then charges back down McPherson Avenue, which runs parallel to the interstate. They cross a mile of real estate in a couple of minutes, with kick, drum, and bass providing syncopated beats to the horrible thumping of errant dead, too slow to get out of the way, colliding with the massive quarter panels and launching into the air like giant flailing birds. More and more of them are emerging from the shadows and trees, awakened by the bellowing growl of the muscle car. Philip's jaw is tense with grim determination as they near another entrance ramp. The brakes lock up at Faith Avenue, where a burger wind burns out of control, the whole area fog-bound with greasy smoke. This ramp is blocked worse than the last. Philip yells a garbled curse, and then slams the thing into reverse, rocketing backward. The Escalade swerves over to an adjacent side street. Another yank of the steering wheel, another kick of the pedal. Now they're burning rubber again, moving westward, weaving around roadblocks, heading toward the skyscrapers in the distance, which loom larger and larger like apparitions in the haze. The increasing number of blocked streets, debris, ruined cars, and wandering dead seem insurmountable, but Philip Blake will not be denied. He sits hunched over the wheel, breathing thickly, eyes fixed on the horizon. He passes a Publix grocery store that looks as though it's been bombed in a blitzkrieg, its lot infested with dead. Philip increases his speed in order to plow through a file of zombies in the street. The tide of gore splashing up across the SUV's huge hood is spectacular, a lurid display of morbid tissue spraying up and blossoming across the windshield. Wipers swish and streak the gruesome remains. In the back seat, Brian turns to his niece.
"Kiddo,
No answer.
Penny?
The child's vacant stare is fixed on the technicolor display across the windshield. She doesn't seem to hear Brian over the din of rock and roll and the rumble of the car. Or perhaps she chooses not to hear him. Or perhaps she's too far gone to hear anything. Brian gently taps her shoulder and she snaps her gaze at him. Then Brian reaches across her and carefully writes a single word on the inside of her fogged window. Away. Brian remembers reading somewhere that the Atlanta metro area was up to almost 6 million people. He remembers being surprised at the number. Atlanta always seemed to Brian to be a sort of miniature metropolis, a mere token of southern progress, isolated in a sea of sleepy little redneck burgs. The few visits he had taken to the city at ground level gave him the impression that the town was one giant suburb. Sure, it had its midtown canyon of tall buildings, it had Turner and Coke and Delta and the Falcons and all the rest, but mostly it seemed like a little sister to the great northern cities. Brian had been to New York once, visiting his ex-wife's family, and that vast, grimy, claustrophobic ant farm had seemed like a real city to Brian. Atlanta seemed like a simulacrum of a city. Maybe part of it was the town's history, which Brian remembers learning about in a college survey course. During Reconstruction, after Sherman had torched the place, the planners decided to let the old historic landmarks go the way of the dodo bird. And over the next century and a half, Atlanta got tarted up in steel and glass. Unlike other southern towns like Savannah and New Orleans, where the flavor of the old South still proudly permeates, Atlanta turned to the bland surfaces of modern expressionism. "Look, Ma," they seemed to say, "we're progressive, we're cosmopolitan, we're cool, not like those bumpkins in Birmingham." But to Brian, it always seemed like the Lady Atlanta doth protested too much. To Brian, Atlanta had always been a pretend city.